Greetings, friends. Welcome back to Critically Acclaimed, the film review podcast, where we do great work reviewing films.
Yeah, we try.
We review films. My name is Whitney Seibold. I am a film critic. I review films. With me, as always, is my scintillating and incredibly intelligent, talented, and popular co-host, William. Why don't you introduce yourself?
You know, I usually fight your compliments tooth and nail, but I've been going through a lot of therapy, so I'm just going to say thank you.
There you go. That's all you need to do.
Yeah. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs, and we mostly review films. Mostly.
That's what this podcast is for.
Indeed.
We review other things as well.
Mostly reviews.
But you'll have to go to the other podcasts for that.
Yeah, I guess it is kind of 50-50 nowadays, isn't it? With all of our Patreon podcasts. Yeah, we do a lot of a lot of TV too,
but we are reviewing a feature film based on a TV program.
That's true. We are reviewing a bunch of new movies this week on Critically Acclaimed, including Paw Patrol the movie.
They made a movie.
What? Reminiscence, The Night House, Demonic, The Protégé, and Cryptozoo. I don't know why I said it like that.
Because I guess you're turning into Mr. Movie Phone.
Oh, yeah.
You're going to take the job away from Gray Drake.
Oh, did she do the, if you call in, do you hear Gray's voice now?
You know what? Every so often I will call 777-FILM just to see. And it has been disconnected for quite some time.
Oh, no.
Yeah,
Someone needs to buy that number back. Someone needs to just get the number and like just do something with it.
It occurs to me that a lot of our listeners probably don't know what Movie Phone is. Like the phone part.
So it used to be.
We've explained it before, but
before the internet was available in everyone's like pocket, you didn't necessarily know where movies were playing. And this is the most important thing we still had newspapers for, because they had in the entertainment or the calendar section, as we have in the LA Times, they would have listings at all the local movie theaters and all the local times for all the local movies. However, if you were out and about.
And you wanted to know what a movie was playing.
Yeah, or if you just don't have a recent newspaper, which is a thing that could happen, you could call a phone number and you would hear advertisements for movies, and you could like type in the name of the movie you wanted to hear times for, and they would tell you based on your zip code where they were playing, they were playing.
You would dial your area code and 777-FILM, and you'd enter your area code and the first three letters of the movie title, which distressed me when movies like Go came out.
Oh, yeah.
Because they had to, like, add an extra option for that. And, yeah, they would tell you which local theaters, and they would, sorted by distance, how far away they were, you could get, like, more and more theaters that were playing that particular movie and the times it was showing.
It's kind of irrelevant now because we can just check on the internet. It's a little bit more convenient. But, you know, I feel like there's nostalgia for this. I feel like if someone could purchase the number and do something fun with it.
There you go.
Yeah. I don't know. Everyone's texting now anyway. No one's actually using their phone.
How long before you could just dial in the audio of a feature film? You just hear the whole movie. Not like new films. I know they'd want to protect those.
Oh, sure.
But like dial in like a classic movie. And you just hear all the audio for one of your favorite films.
That's an interesting idea. That sounds like an app more than anything else.
Did you ever use an audio cassette to tape the audio? Just the audio of your favorite movies?
You know, I know a lot of people who did that.
And re-listen to it?
I know a lot of people who did that. I never did.
I did it occasionally.
Yeah. Okay. I was using my the handheld tape recorder that I was able to acquire when I was a kid to do radio shows. And I would interview myself because I saw the movie The Commitments. And the guy in The Commitments did that. And I thought it was pretty clever.
Yeah. I hope those tapes still exist somewhere.
They do not.
Oh,
they have long since been destroyed. Just threw them in front of a damn big rolly thing. What's that big rolly thing?
It's called a steamroller.
Or
I think, a resurfacer?
No, it was a steamroller. I threw it in front of a steamroller, which would have been funny if I had said it the first time instead of needing you to tell me what it was.
Speaking of steamrollers, one film is steamrolling all of the others in the box. No, I don't. I got no segue. There's no giant hit this week.
No.
Although Paw Patrol the movie is doing pretty good business. Do you want to talk about Paw Patrol first?
Let's talk about Paw Patrol the movie. Paw Patrol is an interesting example of a movie where, for once, Whitney knows way more about this pop culture phenomenon than I do. Frequently, I find myself having to explain, like, what Green Lanterns are all about or some shit to Whitney. This time, Whitney gets to explain it to me because I've never seen this show. It's a kid's show about dogs who do public works, and everyone loves it. It sells a ton of merchandise, and I've never seen more than like a second of it. Like, I think I saw a commercial for it once.
I have a young child.
Yes.
He is actually starting first grade tomorrow as of this recording.
Ooh, fancy.
So, but yeah, I got to spend a good amount of time watching Paw Patrol. It is a Canadian program. And yes, it is about a writer, a young boy. Mm-hmm. Who I suspect is really hundreds of years old.
Yeah, I have my own theories about
this. And is using genetic
show
engineering
too.
To stay young. Because all of the animals in this universe do not speak except for dogs. Dogs speak, and they can speak to humans. Mm. They speak English to human beings.
And humans do not find this odd?
No.
It's not like, oh my god, a talking dog. It's like, nope, this is the status quo.
But Ryder and his team of pups are going to save the day at Adventure Bay, which I assume is somewhere on the west coast of Canada.
Mm-hmm. And, the West Coast, some no. I think it's the East Coast.
It's East Coast of Canada.
Why do I think it was the East Coast? I think there was some sort of inclination in the geography in this movie. I think it's because the metropolis that they end up going to looks like it's modeled after New York.
Okay,
I think that's why I assumed it's on the East Coast.
Probably modeled after Toronto, but they live in a small sleepy town called Adventure Bay, and there are frequently low level crises around town.
Mm-hmm.
To which a police dog, a fire dog, a construction dog, a recycling dog, a beach dog, and a flying dog all will occasionally be dispatched to take care of.
Don't get excited. She just flies a helicopter.
She has a jetpack and flies in a helicopter. Her name is Sky.
Yeah. And apparently they've been on a whole bunch of adventures, but in the movie, a little different. We
start in Adventure Bay.
Set the stage.
Okay.
Let me set the stage. We start in Adventure Bay, where a horrific truck accident occurs, and like this giant tanker truck is like hanging off of a bridge, and you think to yourself, oh my goodness, this is a horrible disaster. A lot of people could be hurt. So we send an 11-year-old and his puppies to save everyone. And they do.
They are well-equipped puppies.
Very well-equipped.
And they have human intelligence.
They have a lot of expensive gadgets. They send all these dogs. The dogs rescue the guy. The guy is initially a little skeptical about this whole dog rescue thing. But then they rescue him. And it turns out that the tanker truck is leaking suspicious fluid. But it's okay because it's maple syrup. And then the dogs eat it all, and I assume the guy gets fired for losing the entire haul. In any case, major crisis averted, which is important.
The truck driver is played by Tyler Perry. They got some like celebrity cameos in this one. And I believe they have completely recast it, because the puppies and Ryder are all played by kid actors.
And they grow up, don't they?
Their voices are going to change eventually, so they have to kind of keep on recycling actors.
That's why frequently in animated movies and TV shows in particular, they cast adults as
to play the
kids, the
children characters.
Because their voices aren't going to change, and so you don't have to worry about that. But anyway, disaster strikes because in a free election, someone got elected who the Paw Patrol doesn't like. And now they have to move to the Adventure City?
Yeah, Adventure City.
And you have to go to Adventure City, this big metropolis, and they move in.
They have a brand new headquarters tower, which is even more elaborate than the one they had in Adventure Bay.
Yep.
All new outfits, all new vehicles.
They establish that the reason they can afford this is because they've been selling Paw Patrol merch, which confirms that these are private citizens. This is a private takeover of public works. These people do not answer to the government. They do not answer to the people. They have no oversight. They are completely self-funded. They have no jurisdictional issues. And what's also upsetting about Adventure City is that when they get there, there are no other cops, construction workers, recyclers, whatever. This city has been completely devoid of any oversight. And let me tell you something. Oh. I'm watching this movie, and I'm getting a really strong defund the police vibe. Because, A, apparently this metropolis was fine before any of these people showed up.
Well, it didn't start going to hell until Mayor Humdinger was elected mayor, or maybe murdered his opponent. It's implied.
How is it implied that he murdered his opponent?
His opponent, like, just mysteriously was, like, vanished from the race, and he was elected by default.
Okay.
Like, at the last minute.
Well, and so we're actually going through something like this right now with the California recall, where if you don't vote against the recall in California, Governor Newsom will be removed from office, and whoever gets the most votes will become the new governor, even if it's not him, or even if he got, like, more votes than them, apparently, which is this weird situation. So democracy is flawed. So in any case, so this guy ran unopposed, which you feel like really shouldn't even be a thing, but he ran unopposed, and he was legally elected the mayor of this town, and he immediately sets to work on a variety of projects. There's a big fireworks display he wants to put together. He's renovated the subway. And by the way, say what you will, in record time. He renovated the entire subway in one day he did that.
As we learn, it's an incredibly stupid idea that a reporter named Miles Muckraker, played by Jimmy Kimmel in another celebrity cameo, has pointed out that A, it's a really stupid idea to renovate a subway that's working perfectly well, and B, did it very shoddily, and indeed it falls apart at the first available opportunity.
Well, it's not just that it's a subway that has been renovated, it's that he renovated it to be A, above ground, which just kind of defeats the purpose of the space-saving measure of having a subway, but also he turned it into a roller coaster loop-de-loo, which it was not designed for, and it goes really, really bad.
So the Paw Patrol are dispatched to rescue the people aboard those cars.
The big drama with the Paw Patrol, inside the Paw Patrol, the internal drama of the Paw Patrol, stems from, who's the police dog?
Chase is the police dog.
Yep.
Marshall is the fire dog. They all have kind of clever names, you see.
Okay.
Rubble is the construction dog. Mm-hmm. Sky is the flying dog. Mm-hmm. Zuma is the beach dog.
Because of
Zuma Beach.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And Rocky is the recycling dog.
Because we recycle rocks.
Rocky is maybe the least useful. Rocky has nothing to do in the show.
Nothing.
Either.
Rocky is there. Rocky collected his paycheck. And then he fucked off.
Rocky and Zuma both have very little to do, both in this movie and in the show.
Nice. But what happens is when they get to this city, the first thing they do, the first like big crisis that happens is there's a big fireworks display that Mayor Humdinger gets a little like self-conscious about. So he unleashes all the fireworks at once, but he starts aiming them like instead of in the sky. So it becomes this huge, you know, giant fire hazard. Millions of people could die. And so the first thing that the Paw Patrol sends is the cops. Because they have
to establish a perimeter.
Sure.
And
that's what matters most. We have to establish the perimeter.
They establish a perimeter while Sky tries to find like the source of the problem and while Marshall is putting out fires. It's not like... they're doing all of these things at once.
I appreciate that, but the first person they send them out one at a time, and their top priority is to send the cops, presumably to arrest people. He sets up a perimeter. Chase the perimeter, of course, is so secure because they have such high tech information that it would actually hinder the evacuation process, which I thought was kind of funny. And Chase is on top of everything, and this is the drama I was alluding to. Chase is suffering from PTSD.
Chase, we learn in flashbacks, came from Adventure City. He was found there by Ryder when he was a stray puppy, an even younger puppy.
Mm-hmm.
And we get to see baby Chase. He's a baby puppy.
Yeah.
He's cute.
Yeah.
And he is having also an image crisis. Chase is the police dog. He's the ostensible leader of the dog characters.
Mm-hmm.
He's kind of the main character of the show. I think he gets the most screen time.
Mm-hmm.
And he wants to be seen as a heroic figure.
Yeah, again, but, you see the problems with the police force, but okay.
And his crisis is that when he arrives back in the city, he becomes afraid again.
Yeah.
And starts to shrink away from his responsibilities because he's too scared.
Which is why, of course, Ryder puts Chase immediately on administrative leave, insists that he go to therapy, and actually, like, does something to, like, solve this problem.
He does. He takes him back to the site where he found him and restages his bad memories.
Okay, that could be incredibly triggering. That's actually not advisable in most situations. That's seriously not the best. Also, I'm sorry, Ryder is not, like, trained in psychotherapy.
We don't know that.
Is Ryder trained in psychotherapy?
Yes. Ryder has several degrees.
Yeah.
Okay. One of them is in psychotherapy.
So we've got this completely incompetent politician in charge. He's destroying everything in Adventure City. But the big problem is that the cop has, like, an image problem.
Well, the other Paw Patroller are all also on the case. Mayor Humdinger also hates dogs and is trying to lock them all away.
Oh yeah, he's actually got, like,
he has cat equivalents of all of the Paw Patrol, but the cats don't speak or do anything heroic. They're kind of villainous cats.
They don't even do anything particularly villainous either. They're just sort of there. We do get to see Chase gets picked up and sent to the... They've actually taken... It's not even the pound.
It's an obedience school.
They have taken over an obedience school and turned it into an internment camp for dogs.
Mm-hmm.
Which, again, a lot of subtext there. We're not really going to engage with any of that.
Pretty rough stuff for a G-rated kids movie.
Yeah.
We do meet a poodle in there, played by Kim Kardashian, another celebrity cameo.
Yay.
And we also haven't mentioned the ancillary Paw Patrol character, the one who knows the city, a character named Liberty, who is a dachshund, who is a stray.
Yeah.
And is the one who is called the Paw Patrol to Adventure City to begin with.
Yeah,
and
she's a big Paw Patrol fan, and she wants to join them, but they haven't actually, like, invited her to do so, except they're totally going to, because that's literally the reason the character is here. Mm. We've got a new movie, we have to sell some more merch, here's a new character.
Which is curious, because there are other, like, ancillary Paw Patrol characters already.
Oh.
There is a husky, like a snow dog.
Uh-huh.
Named Everest.
Cute.
And there's a chihuahua whose name I can't remember.
Okay.
What's
the chihuahua's, like, specialty?
The Everest lives in the snow, and the chihuahua lives out, like, in the jungles, like, in the forests.
What's weird is that mostly the dogs seem to have, like, some kind of vague connection to whatever their specialty is. We've got a wiener dog.
Tracker is the name of the chihuahua.
We've got a dachshund. Dachshunds are burrowers. They're actually, like, bred to, like, go down into, like, rat holes and hunt rats.
Yeah.
So she's a verminator. She's an exterminator dog. And now she gets a Vespa. Like, that's her big shtick at the end of the movie. They give her a Vespa.
And as we learned from the movie Luca... Those things are amazing.
Yes. Luca, don't you just love Vespas, buddy? He's mad at us for reviewing the dog movie.
How dare you?
Cat just gave me a big old fuck-off face.
Staring daggers because we're talking about the Paw Patrol.
You know, I jest about Paw Patrol because it doesn't seem to be terribly well developed thematically. Like, I'm seriously, like, the last time I saw a movie that I can recall in which... a big city was taken over by complete privatization of public works. It was RoboCop, and it didn't work out great for everybody.
That was a satire.
Yeah, but generally speaking, that's what we're talking about here. But yet this movie is very utopian, which is sort of hard for me to wrap my head around.
Well, the Paw Patrol don't, like you said, that they got a lot of money from merchandise sales, but they're probably a not-for-profit organization.
Making a profit.
Well, not for profit means they're allowed to earn profit, but all of the money they get has to go into the works first.
Ah.
It's slightly different than a non-profit. Mm-hmm. And plus, it is a Canadian
show. I just
want to
see the 11-year-old talk with his accountant and lawyer about all of this stuff. It's just
this is why I suspect Ryder is like...
Save your receipts, Ryder.
Secretly an adult who's like genetically engineered himself to be young forever, but... Nice. Also, it's Canadian, so maybe it is part of the public works. Maybe they just have really well-funded public works, because it's Canada, and they have wonderful medicine there. There's no ambulance dog, which I found a little bit curious.
No one gets hurt.
Yeah.
There's no injury.
I guess that would be something they'd have to deal with. You'd have to start hurting characters on the show. This is a G-rated film. It's the first G-rated film I've seen in a long time, in fact.
Yeah, they don't make them as often as they used to.
And even when Disney makes an animated film, I'm thinking it's because of the style of the animation. It's all CG now. Mm-hmm. It's a lot more realistic. They're adding like actual gravity, and things seem a little bit more dangerous in that form of animation.
It's also
so
just
the films
G's
are now rated PG.
They're trying to G is not cool, and PG is considered completely tame anyway. So at this point, they just don't care.
It stands for practically G.
So I'm watching this movie, and you know, there's some things that kind of bug me about it. I don't like that there are gags about how one of the dogs accidentally dresses up as a lady dog and people laugh at him. That seems like a shitty joke. But honestly, the majority of this movie is just vaguely harmless. That's the vibe I get. This is vaguely harmless.
Everything's round and friendly because this, you know, Paw Patrol is a show that appeals to four-year-olds. It's a very simple, very easy to consume. It's incredibly innocuous. There's never anything in the way of like actual peril. If you think this is innocuous, the TV show is even blander. Like this, even the color palette isn't that interesting.
Is it because it's bad, or is it because it's trying really hard to just be reassuring?
Well, I think it's just supposed to be easy to understand for a very young child.
Okay.
So it's not terribly complicated. The jokes are very simple. Uh-huh. One of the dogs falls over a lot. You're 4 years old. That's funny.
It's okay.
You know, we're not dealing with, you know, witty Noel Coward level bon mots in Paw Patrol.
Noel Coward would have been a great pass on this script. You gotta
Yes, we are all dogs, aren't we? I'm watching this film, and you know, I actually watched this with my son. He's six. He's a little too old. He was just sort of kind of reminding himself of the years when he watched Paw Patrol. But he watched the whole thing. He was really engaged. He liked the new vehicles. It's incredibly toyetic. It's designed to be.
Mm-hmm.
Each character
sell those products. Yeah.
Sell the toys. Sell each character has their own toy. Each one like expands. Now you have new toys.
Such a lunchbox.
Pretty much. Yeah. There was a
what
little
lunchbox
bit of...
did you have as a kid? Did you ever have a lunchbox with like stuff on it?
I had a Peanuts lunchbox.
Okay, I had a Transformers and a G.I. Joe lunchbox. Those are my two. I'm just curious. I don't know why. It was such a status symbol for a while. Like, what was on your lunch pack? Oh, G.I. Joe kid. Kind of a badass.
I had an aluminum Peanuts lunchbox, and then I upgraded to a plastic one when those became hip. Mm. And that was sort of like store brand. It was like generic robot.
Which is so weird because the aluminum seemed so much cooler. It's actually like kind of like stamped, so it actually had like depth to mine, you know?
The problem is, I think kids were like clocking each other with those things.
They're clocking each other with the plastic ones, too.
Less damage to the face.
Tell that to the dinosaurs.
whose remnants we made the lunchbox out of.
Yeah, it's kind of dark if you think about it.
What I appreciate about Paw Patrol is it does have, because it is trying to appeal to a younger audience, or just because the way it's presented, we have a greater just clarity of action. It's not so overstuffed, so it's actually just easy to watch.
Yeah.
You can tell what's going on in a way that I think a lot of mainstream blockbusters used to have and don't anymore. Things are a lot more chaotic now.
Yeah.
And there's actually more raw displays of like derring do and heroism in a movie like Paw Patrol than in movies with superheroes in them.
I actually appreciate
superhero movies are about fighting.
Yeah.
They're not and victory and power. They're rarely about heroism.
Well, that's one of the things I actually do like about this is that I do like that. I think the emphasis on Chase is misguided, especially considering that really you don't need him for any of the stuff that happens in this movie. Like if he arrested Mayor Humdinger, I'd be like, fine.
Yeah.
But everything else, it feels like everyone else is more qualified than him. And like, so again, this is that defund the police situation, which is we're spending too much money on the police to have the police solve problems that they're not even qualified for. And instead of giving the police money to do these things, to come in with the police mentality, you give people who are actually trained for those situations the funds instead, so that the situations are resolved without people getting shot. So Chase doesn't shoot anyone that I know.
Chase doesn't have a gun.
Chase actually does have a gun. He shoots like the fire guy has a gun.
Marshall
has a water gun.
Has a but he's a fire dog.
I'm not saying it's unjustified. I'm just saying. Yeah. Anyway, my point is they're not anti-guns in general, but my point is this. I feel like the emphasis on Chase feels a little misguided here, and I feel like the reason why he gets that drama is because ultimately, yeah, this isn't about doing anything to do with cop stuff. Mm. This is about building things, fixing things, saving people from perilous situations that have nothing to do with violence per se.
They're incredibly akin to the Thunderbirds, if you're familiar with Gerry Anderson.
Vaguely. You watched it more than I did. I don't remember very well. I know of it. Tell people about Thunderbirds.
Thunderbirds, they made a movie in the early 2000s, but it's a...
directed by Jonathan Frakes.
That's right. It had Ben Kingsley and Bill Paxton in it. Yeah, I think Bill Paxton. Anyway, the original show goes back to the 1960s, where and it was filmed in what they called Super Marionation. Gerry and Sylvia Anderson pioneered a marionette adventure show for kids. And the central team on Thunderbirds was called International Rescue. They had a satellite up in space. They could tell when people were in trouble, and they would fly their like gigantic super futuristic machines, each with a bright color and a number to help people in peril.
It was Bill Paxton, by the way.
It was Bill Paxton.
Just to confirm.
Hooray, I got a Schmodown question right.
That's
about
an obscure one.
The movie's not very good. The two Super Marionation Thunderbirds movies, Thunderbirds Argo and Thunderbird 6, are good movies. I enjoy those movies.
Really? Okay.
But yeah, they're a team of international rescuers. They just go around the world, and if they're privately funded, they're using their wealth for good to help people in trouble.
Yeah.
In immediate peril, and they use their gigantic super machines to save people. I feel the same way about the Paw Patrol.
Yeah.
They have these super machines, they have highly trained young people, in this case dogs, who go out into the city and rescue people. And that's a fine enough premise for a kid's show.
I wish more superhero stuff was about rescuing people than it feels like it used to be. Like, one of my favorite bits in any MCU movie is that bit in Iron Man 3 where he has to like rescue
people. The people falling from the plane.
They threw a whole bunch of people off a plane, and Iron Man, who doesn't really have a parachute, has to find a way to save the life of like a dozen people free falling out of an airplane. Mm. And it's a logistical nightmare, but he figures out a way to do it, and it's like, actually impressive.
He like shocks their hands so they like grab at a certain time and like has to like change the angle of descent and like lures them into water.
It's only about saving lives at that point. It's not about fighting monsters or robots or nothing. It's only about saving lives. And I'm not saying that should be everything in a superhero movie, but
it should be.
It feels like there should be more of it.
There should be at least two of those sequences in every superhero movie.
I think so. Like, I really like that sequence in Spider-Man Homecoming where he has to like pull a whole boat together, you know, like with the webs. That's actually a bit where he's got to do something just genuinely just heroic. And although I think he was partly responsible for that, but anyway.
He was responsible for that, and it wasn't as fun as the sequence in
Spider-Man 2
where he's trying to stop the speeding train. That kind of stuff is a lot more exciting because superheroes are doing heroic things and they're rescuing people on a level in which we can understand.
Yeah.
There's an upcoming superhero movie where they're rescuing the planet in such a way that no human beings would ever know about it. Which seems to be the métier of a lot of the Marvel films now. Mm-hmm. There's like some evil space god that they have to fight on another planet, and wouldn't you know it, we happen to be at risk, but we would never know about it because it's on a distant planet. It's
that's selfless, isn't it?
I suppose it's...
We're not pursuing fame or anything for that. We're just doing it to do it.
But they're still getting that fame. That's a little bit of a loophole in those movies.
Well, whatever.
But it's a lot more relatable when they're doing something like saving somebody from a speeding car.
Yeah.
Something a person would recognize. And the Paw Patrol does that. There's a scene where a car is, like, pushed through the air and they catch it in a net and they save people. There's a bit
Spider-Man did it first, but okay.
Fine. There's a bit where something's falling over and they have to, the subway track is falling over and they have to catch it with their cables and guide people out. It's actually kind
Spider-Man
of
did it first, but okay.
And they shore up the bottom with some cement. Mm-hmm. That kind of heroism, I think, is a healthier thing for kids to see than just people fighting one another.
Yeah, I nitpick this because it's easy to do because, frankly, it's a little drab. There's a lot of room for an adult's mind to roam while you're watching this movie. Yeah,
I said it's innocuous and it's a lot more dynamic than the TV show.
Well, that's good to hear.
And you know, they did actually bother to upgrade a lot of the visuals and a lot of the, you know, the setting and the scenario and writer looks completely different.
I don't love this, but I quote Mr. Burns, I may not know art, but I know what I hate, and I don't hate this.
Okay.
So this is, for a kids movie, this is mostly harmless. Generally speaking, its heart is in the right place, and I think the things that, there's a couple of shitty, like, fat jokes and, like, gendering jokes that we didn't need, but it's not, like, a lot. It's not pervasive. It's just a little disappointing, because otherwise it was so harmless. But generally speaking, yeah, this is a fine little kids movie. Unremarkable, perhaps, but fine. What do you want to talk about next?
You've saw a lot more movies this week than I did, so tell me about one of the ones you got to see.
Okay, I want to talk about a film that really didn't seem to get, like, a lot of buzz, but I actually had a blast with The Protégé.
Okay, with Maggie Q.
Maggie Q, Samuel L. Jackson, and Michael Keaton star in a new thriller from director Martin Campbell, who did The Mask of Zorro, No Escape, Casino Royale, and also some real pieces of crap, like The Legend of Zorro and Green Lantern.
And Vertical Limit. Do you see
that's
that
a mixed bag.
Vertical Limit has some fun stuff.
There's some good stuff in Vertical Limit. Not a great movie.
That's a mountain climbing movie.
Opening, really suspenseful, nicely done. The rest of the movie, it's okay. But Martin Campbell's a really hit or miss filmmaker. And frankly, a lot of people in this cast are kind of hit or miss right now. Samuel L. Jackson is playing the second, like, getting too old for this hitman character he's played this summer. He was already in The Hitman's Wife's Bodyguard.
Oh, that's right.
Which was just fucking awful. Like, the original Hitman's Wife, the original Hitman's Bodyguard is reasonably entertaining fluff. It's too long, but the actors are charming enough, you get by.
To his credit, Samuel L. Jackson is in his early 70s.
Oh, sure. And listen, he can coast on charm. If he wants to. My point is this. The Hitman's Wife's Bodyguard feels like one of those movies where everyone had fun making it, but it doesn't translate to having fun watching it. Because they're just sort of yelling at each other the whole time. There's no real attention being paid to pacing or character or whether anything's actually funny. It's just sort of, we got the gang back together. And I'm like, we didn't want to go to this reunion. It's awful. So That set the bar pretty low, I'll admit. But here he's actually giving a pretty sweet performance. He plays a hitman who, years ago, rescued a young girl who, when he had gotten to the place where he was supposed to kill everybody was already dead because this little girl had killed him. So he has decided to take her under his wing and make her his protege. Years have gone by.
Not get her therapy and make sure she's okay.
Well, she seems to be pretty well put together for the most part.
She just murders people.
There's a reason for it, but I'm not going to give away every twist in the movie. But yeah, years go by, and they become good partners, good friends, very supportive of each other. They're very loving. They kill people who, in their estimation, are bad, but they're under no assumption that they're good people. Samuel L. Jackson, we realize pretty early on into the movie, is dying. He's got, they don't go into specifics, but he's got a really bad cough, so he's probably got, you know, lung cancer or emphysema or something that's gonna take him away before too long. And he's just deciding to put his affairs in order, and he's making long-term plans for Maggie Q to sort of invest in her, you know, sort of cover business so that she can actually pursue her dreams outside of being an assassin. And he's also sort of checking in on some of the assignments that always bugged him in the past. And it turns out that there is someone that he assassinated and they had left behind a kid. And he was never able to track down the kid. And he just wanted to make sure that kid turned out okay. However, in starting to research the location of this child, they find something. And I'm not going to tell you what, but they find something they weren't supposed to find. And now a bunch of assassins are after Maggie Q and Samuel L. Jackson. One of the people in this assassin group is played by Michael Keaton. Michael Keaton and I know exactly what I'm saying when I say this, has never been sexier. Michael Keaton is a dish in this movie. He has really good chemistry with Maggie Q.
Okay.
He's
quite a fine actor.
He's a fine actor. It's been a while since he's played a leading man who was, like, really dashing.
Hmm.
Like, he was doing that in, like, the 80s, more so the 90s. And then sometime around the turn of the century, he just settled into more character work, more funny supporting characters, and your sort of out of sight kind of mold. And then he started like playing with his type in Birdman. So it's kind of nice to just see him playing like a suave, cool guy again. Because he started off funny, he started playing suave, cool, and then he started playing. It's nice to see him in a role that's just like, ooh, Michael Keaton. Nice. So, yeah, Maggie Q is trying to fight the bad guys who are trying to kill her. Michael Keaton may be one of those bad guys, but either way, they really want to fuck. And that's kind of the whole movie.
All right.
Everyone's trying to kill each other. Two of them are trying to fuck and possibly try to kill each other. And that's basically it. It's a little uncomplicated, but in a way that's actually kind of relaxing. Like, and I don't mean that in a bad way. You don't think, like, an action movie is relaxing, but, like, there's so many action movies that are trying to be all intense all the time. Yeah. And what I feel like The Protégé is actually a very mature action movie in that it knows we don't need that. We'll be exciting when the time comes. We'll have a great shootout when the time comes. We'll have a great fight scene when the time comes. But in the middle, we can actually let this really good cast play their characters and be good at it and establish relationships so that you give a shit about what happens.
Nice? Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of just refreshingly like smart and mature about it. And it's still, at the end of the day, there's not a lot to this movie.
Okay.
It's not like a lot of like really fascinating resonant themes. There's stuff about like, you know, regrets and like, you know, dealing with your trauma and like how the choices that you make dictate. All that stuff is like kind of assassin movie 101 kind of stuff, but as a genre film where the expectation is we're gonna get some cool shootouts, we're gonna get some cool fights, and we've got a good cast and we didn't waste them, this is rock solid.
All right.
And I had a really, really good time watching it, so I do hope that people don't overlook this one. I realize that it's theaters only and it's not like it's not getting like a huge marketing push. I don't know how well it is. I'd be surprised if it's doing great. But when you get an opportunity to see this one, whether you see it in a theater if you feel safe enough, or you wait for home video or streaming, check it out. I just really was just kind of pleasantly surprised at how 3.5 stars this movie is.
Okay.
Not all-time classic, but I'm glad I saw it, because it's just a well-done action movie.
Yeah, I prefer action movies that have a lot of character moments. Like witty characters.
Yeah.
You can put that in any kind of movie, but where we get to sort of stop the action and they get to do things that are not action. I find action characters that are just sort of unstoppable action machines to be one of the most boring types of characters.
Yeah, because that's all there has to do.
Even if they're funny or witty, if they're unkillable action machines, which is like every character.
Look at the difference between John McClane in Die Hard and John McClane in A Good Day to Die Hard.
Yeah.
He goes from a really interesting character to a really boring character. Because all this destruction and mayhem, it's nothing to him now. He's done it so many times.
Yeah, like he's able to destroy helicopters by jumping cars at them before he could barely walk because he stepped on broken glass.
Yeah, he's more interesting the first time out because he feels human.
Mm.
Yeah, and that's kind of the vibe this is going for. This feels more like how action movies used to be in the 70s, which is to say it was basically a crime drama with like 4 good action sequences in it, as opposed to a whole bunch of action sequences and we'll figure out the connective tissue later because who gives a shit. Which can also sometimes make a good movie, but usually only like a good action movie, a good spectacular or stunt spectacle. But yeah, this is just a solid crime movie with a really, really good cast. Michael Keaton's really great in it. Samuel L. Jackson is not phoning this one in. He's actually really giving like, I'm not that he's like known for doing that, but it feels like sometimes all he's asked to do is be Samuel L. Jackson, and when that's the case, he doesn't do much more than that. He's there, but he's doing his job, and his job is to be Samuel L. Jackson. But here, he's asked to give a performance and actually like establish a meaningful relationship and show that he cares and thinks about things, and it's nice to see him being asked to do that. Because, again, I saw the hitman's wife's bodyguard, and he's not asked to do that. He's just coasting on being Samuel L. Jackson because that's all they ask of him. And here, this is a really, really good counterpoint to that. So, anyway, The Protégé. Solid film. I hope more people see it. Again, not amazing. Probably won't make my best films of the year list. But solid recommendation. Why don't we talk about another movie we both saw? Why don't we talk about Reminiscence?
Oh, Reminiscence.
A new film on HBO Max and also in theaters.
Yeah, this is the first feature film directed by Lisa Joy, who created the hit TV series Westworld.
Co-created. I mean, Michael Crichton did the original work.
Based on the novel by Michael Crichton.
Yeah, but Lisa Joy co-developed it into the HBO series.
She wrote, directed, and produced this. This is like her baby, and... golly, she likes noir novels, doesn't she? Reminiscence takes place in a near future Miami, and I love the sense of place in this movie because they put a lot of detail into this. Florida is sinking under the ocean, so people are constantly walking down wet streets. There are portions of the city that are completely submerged. Mm. The entire geography has been completely worked around. People travel by boat. It's a really interesting setup. And into the future...
First time I ever saw that setup was a movie called Split Second.
I was going to bring up the movie Split Second, yes! Which I watched recently.
You only watched that recently?
Yeah, for the first time recently.
Oh, does it hold up?
No.
I remember liking it so much.
It stars Rutger Hauer, who's after a monster that we barely see in the movie. Yeah. Kim Cattrall is in it for like two scenes. And you can tell she just walked off the set of Star Trek VI because she has the exact same hairdo. Sure, she shaved off her sideburns and they're still missing in this movie. Clear the day after she shot Star Trek VI, she did her scenes for Split Second.
But one of the conceits is it's the near future and everything's flooded.
Everything's flooded.
Polar ice caps melted.
It's just like a Simon Lang film. Everything's wet. And
just like
Simon Lang. And Hugh Jackman is the hard, grizzled, completely cliched noir hero. What is his name? Like Buckturd.
Nick Bannister.
Nick Bannister is his name. And he makes a lot of allusions to being a veteran of a war that happened recently.
Which you'd think would amount to something, but it doesn't.
He and a friend of his, played by Tandy Newton.
Tandy Newton. Yeah, she's gone back to original name.
Original spelling. They run a memory service. And this has got Philip K. Dick all over it. And, people can come in, put little electrodes on their heads and lay in a tank of water and relive old memories, memories.
It's like Total Recall, except they don't give you new memories. They just allow you to vividly relive your old memories as if they were happening right now.
And looking into the past and finding out the truth is a very noir conceit, trying to find out what happened in the past.
It's the premise of every detective story.
This is a wonderful... wonderful plot contrivance to have in a noir story. Mm-hmm. And wouldn't you know it, the femme fatale walks in. Mm. And this is
Rebecca Ferguson,
who played Ilsa Faust in the Mission Impossible movies.
And she had previously starred with Hugh Jackman in The Greatest Showman.
And she's great.
Oh.
I like her a lot.
Generally speaking, I do.
Here she's asked to play a little bit like an inscrutable character, which is a frustrating kind of role to play.
Yeah, I don't think it's kind of designed for her. I think she's just so open and warm a lot. Even in the Mission Impossible movies where she was like mysterious
character,
but she was still like outgoing and gregarious, and that's kind of just a better vibe for her.
Okay.
I don't like it. Seeing her restrained, you can feel the restraint. That she's being forced to do, but anyway, anyways.
Playing this sort of torn character in Reminiscence is better than that ridiculous vampire she played in the Shining 2.
Oh, shush. I love Rose the Hat. I love Rose the Hat. You're wrong about
that. She's called Rose the Hat because she wears a hat.
She wears a hat?
Uh-huh.
What? If you always wore a hat...
That is a stupid movie, man.
Stupidly brilliant.
I do not like Dr. Sleep.
And you're very wrong, but that's fine. We can disagree.
But she walks in, of course, and they film her from behind, and she's wearing a slinky dress, and Hugh Jackman falls in love immediately, or Nick Bannister falls in love immediately.
I like that she comes in specifically because she lost
her keys. She lost her keys.
Like,
so they
everyone else is like, I wanted to relive the greatest love affair of my life. There's a guy who lost his legs in the war, and he wants to remember when he would be able to run around with his own dog. All these kind of sweet personal moments. And she's just like, I have no idea where my fucking keys are. They're around somewhere.
So she lays in the tank, and they help her find her keys, but he's fascinated by the world she lives in, finds the bar where she works, and she's of course a cabaret singer. It's very much like Dark City in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I was thinking
getting
that
a lot of Dark City vibes. And he instigates an affair, and they begin having these wonderful memories. And wouldn't you know it, smash cut. While he's remembering this wonderful memory, he sits bolt upright in the tank. Oh no, time has passed.
Uh-huh.
Something's happened to her. She's been missing for months now.
Yeah.
And now the investigation can begin.
I will say this. I thought that gag where, like, the first act of the movie was just him reliving the memories.
Uh-huh.
That was pretty clever.
That was pretty clever. Yeah,
I think it may be the single most clever, because this is a whole idea of this is, you know, this is a sci-fi noir. We're going to take a traditional noir detective kind of story, femme fatales, grizzled detective with the past, searching, you know, finding out the secrets of the world around him.
A lot of incredibly artificial dialogue about the meaning of memory and all the rest of that stuff, which plays fake, I think, on purpose.
Usually, yeah. And even in the best movies like this, they usually have some sort of, even Blade Runner is kind of arch as well. But again, the whole idea is we've invented this new technology. And so we're going to explore how this would affect the world around us. And so in addition to the consumer applications, this is also like legally usable in court. So they have to do stuff like that. But how do we solve a mystery using this sci-fi tech that doesn't really exist?
Yeah.
That's the movie. That's the exercise that we're going through. And does this technology make for a more interesting film noir?
I would say so, because we get to, I think it gives us an organic reason to have flashbacks and to withhold information.
Okay.
It's really frustrating in detective stories where they give us a piece of information and then give us a little bit more later on when they could have easily given it to us at the same time.
Yeah.
Just to prolong the mystery. This one, because of the conceits of the tech, we have a reason to have that some information withheld from us. And I think that works a little bit more organically, at least from my eye. I could also tell what was going on at every minute. You know, it's like a twisty detective story, but you know, I know who all the characters were, you know, who related to whom, why they were going to, you know, any given building at any given moment. I appreciate that they bothered to point out why this amazing technology isn't used in court more often, because what's the American legal system is to find the truth using cross-examination. Why not just put somebody in a tank and find out? And they say, well, because of this corrupt system, because we live in Miami, and because of the circumstances of arrest, and because of, you know, certain people are not permitted to lay in the tank, they actually have, like, legal reasons why they can't be sitting in the tank and use it in courts.
Yeah.
So
they have to have, like, a specific warrant for a specific amount. Like, there's one situation where here's a witness, but he's been in a coma for a while, and this is our only opportunity. So, but we're only allowed to look at certain days and certain information.
Exactly. Otherwise,
it's
like an invasion of privacy. Yeah. So they bothered to talk about that.
That's kind of interesting.
They actually did that. And it turns into, because the Hugh Jackman character is not a detective, he's just been running this as a business, he's very personally involved. He's seeking out Rebecca Ferguson for personal reasons.
Yeah, because he loves her. Yeah.
He's trying to solve the mystery, not because it's a mystery, but because he has something at stake. He wants to find this woman that he's fallen in love with. And in true noir fashion, the deeper he gets into the mystery, the more and more cynicism and pessimism and corruption he ends up uncovering, and it ends on a pretty pessimistic note. It's not that the system works so well that everything's going to be solved. He learns some pretty damning things.
It ends on a noirish note, where people make choices that are not the best choices.
And there's all these morally questionable things. We get a good sense of the universe that it takes place in. We eventually travel into the center of Miami, where the ultra rich have built dams. So it's like dry land for them. And everybody else is sort of like in the watery ghettos. And I thought that was pretty well thought out. I thought that was really interesting. I think this is a pretty fascinating sci-fi noir.
Okay.
I like the ideas in it. I think the dialogue is really dumb, but I think that's kind of I think that's kind of by design.
I think they're going for like an old pulpy 1940s novel vibe. Yeah.
I feel like Hugh Jackman, he's a talented actor. I feel like he could have played up that artificiality a little bit more. And it, as it is, he's just sort of like grisly reading these monologues and it gets kind of boring after a while. But I feel like attaching this memory conceit into a detective story, like I said, it evokes Philip K. Dick in, I think, a very clever way. Mm-hmm. And I think it does let us travel through time and discover things in a really organic fashion. Huh. I kind of dug it. Cool. I know it's getting very bad reviews, but I'm not one of them. I really enjoyed Reminiscence.
I'm glad you did. It didn't quite work for me.
Okay.
All the things that, well, most of the things that you liked about it, I think are the best things about it. Mm-hmm. I do appreciate the level of thought that went into the new tech and how that would affect the world around it and the way that this story unfolds. I think all of that's pretty clever, and it's the reason to make the movie. So if that didn't work, it wouldn't be it'd be completely pointless, and that would be a shame. For me, what it boils down to is this. The entire movie hinges intellectually, perhaps, on the tech. But the narrative, the story, how much I care about what happens next, that is based on the relationship between Hugh Jackman and Rebecca Ferguson.
Yeah.
And how much it means to Hugh Jackman that he would then pursue Rebecca Ferguson come hell or high water, even if it would destroy him. And I don't buy it.
Okay.
I don't think Hugh Jackman and Rebecca Ferguson have great romantic chemistry together. I think that they feel like this whole world feels very downbeat and dour, and their romance feels downbeat and dour. It might be, it might have a little bit of hope to it, but like it still doesn't feel like, oh, we've found our oasis. In this cynical world, or something that feels like it's really like important and special. It feels kind of arbitrary and forced.
I don't think it feels forced, but I do agree that it doesn't feel like a glorious oasis. Mm. It doesn't even feel like a last gasp of connection.
Mm. Doesn't even feel like particularly like horny. It just feels like they just sort of like wound up together.
And which I think is in keeping with the spirit of the film, though. There's a monologue partway through that they repeat where they say, tell me a story.
Yeah.
One of the characters says, tell me a story with a happy ending. And they point out, no story ends well. If it's a happy story, it ends in death.
Mm-hmm.
No story has a happy ending. And so she says, well, tell me half of a story and end it partway.
Yeah.
And that's a big theme of this movie is think. Everything dies. Time destroys everything.
Yeah. And he picks, and it's cute
and he picks the Orpheus and Eurydice,
which is one of those things where I'm like, okay, wait a minute. Maybe pick a story where I don't already know the tragic ending because that's really super famous.
So these lovers named Romeo and Juliet.
Oh, good.
Everything's going to turn out great for them. They get married and that's the end of the story.
But like, that's the thing. And then she actually says like, oh, but she doesn't know the story. And I get it. Not everyone knows everything, but that's pretty famous. You're both in your late 30s. Hugh Jackman's older, I'm sure. Yeah. But like, she's at least in her 30s. Like, come on. What are you doing to us? Well,
I think that's another thing, though, that they're a little older. They're not like 20-somethings. Kind of helps stress that.
I guess. But what it boils down to is this. Here's to tack on to the Romeo and Juliet thing that you just brought up. At the beginning of Romeo and Juliet, Romeo is in love with a woman named Rosalind.
That's right.
And he's got to be in love with her, but he can't be so passionately in love with her that it overshadows his love for Juliet. His love for Juliet needs to be all encompassing.
Right.
I feel like Rebecca Ferguson is Rosalind.
That's how there's another greater love coming along.
I mean, someone. It doesn't have to be yet. Clearly, like, the note that Tindiway Newton was given was that she's a little bit in love with Hugh Jackman. And I think she's great in this movie. I think she's, for me, the standout actor in it. I think she doesn't have as much to do, but she's really...
really natural. She has a lot of horrible, like, personal issues that she's dealing with, but she deals with it very frankly.
Like, a part of me just wishes we just removed Hugh Jackman and had Tindiway Newton was in the lead, and she had the relationship with Rebecca Ferguson, which honestly I'd probably buy more. because I like Hugh Jackman a lot as a performer, but he doesn't really, he generally doesn't work for me as a passionate romantic lead. He tends to seem like his mind is on other things. And I feel like here he's putting on a lot of airs, but he never really feels at home in this role.
Oh, look, you should look up the clip of him talking about rich creamery butter.
In the movie
Kate and Leopold.
Yeah. Okay, I actually like the movie Kate and Leopold. That's one exception. I actually like that movie a lot.
Well, that's sort of like a lighthearted, fantastical comedy film.
It's a frothy movie. And I think he does frothy really, really well. But this sort of intense, passionate love, I've never really seen him do that very well. And I don't think this is the time he did. So what it boils down to is I see a lot of potential here, but
good moments of like genuine sadness in this movie.
You can do sadness, sure, but I'm not seeing the love. And again, the whole point is the whole point of having that first act before the plot kicks in is that we should be convinced of their relationship so that when he does incredible things, it tracks. And I didn't buy it. And I'm just trying to explain why that is, and it's gone on too long. But so I don't love it. I think it's a slight misfire. Maybe it's casting, maybe it's direction, whatever. But like there's a couple of things that are just big enough to hold it back from really working for me. But the things that you like about it are the things I liked about it too. I just think other things could have undermined it. Right. So it's not a complete wash, but I didn't particularly care for it.
Okay.
And that's why.
I was surprised at how much I was enjoying the film. Yeah. It's not a grand classic, but I'm reminded of other fantastical detective films I liked. Yeah. And
because you don't like Blade Runner quite famously. What other fantastical detective films? It's considered maybe the classic of the genre. What other fantastical detective movies do you like?
It was evoking a film like Gregory Hoblit's film Fallen with Denzel Washington, where
more of a horror movie. But
he plays a cop who's going after a killer, and the killer, as it turns out, is a wicked fallen angel that can leap into other people's bodies.
Yeah, that's a great fucking movie.
It's really good, actually. Yeah, it's like incredibly well made too. Yeah. Like there's just excellent editing in that film. A film like that.
Okay,
a film like Fallen. Reminded of that.
Yeah.
Or Total Recall. Like I said, this may as well be a Philip K. Dick story.
Yeah. Well, speaking of horror movies, I saw two of them this week, and weirdly enough, they share a lot in common. Although they have nothing to do with each other specifically. So do you want to hear about the mostly good one, or do you want to hear about the one that sucks a lot?
Tell me about the mostly good one first.
Okay, so The Night House is the latest film from David Bruckner. David Bruckner is a filmmaker who I think is quite on the rise. He's been making a variety of horror films. He did The Signal in 2007, which was an anthology film. He did one of the installments. He did one of the installments in VHS.
The Signal wasn't an anthology film.
In 2007 it was. You're thinking of the Lawrence Fishburne sci-fi movie.
Yeah.
The Signal was like an anthology film about like people going mad because of like a radio signal.
I was thinking of a different film called The Signal.
Two sci-fi movies with the same title. He did a segment in VHS. He did a really excellent segment in this anthology film that most people don't talk about called Southbound, which is all about a bunch of horror taking place along a desert highway. He did a segment.
That was a pretty good movie.
He did a segment called The Accident, which I scared the crap out of me.
Is that the one that takes place in the hospital?
Yeah, where a guy hits somebody and he calls 911 and they tell him what to do, and it gets worse and worse and worse.
Like he's on the phone and he has to take his victim into the empty hospital. Doesn't know why anybody's
there.
It's
such a great nightmare. It's a really, really scary segment. Like it works really well. And then he did a movie in 2017, which was mostly good. I don't think it ever quite achieved true greatness, but The Ritual, which, if nothing else, had a really great monster in it.
Yeah.
So he's back with a new film called The Night House. It stars Rebecca Hall, who, if you know me, you know I'm a huge fan and have been ever since the movie Christine. I think she's one of the best actors working today. I think very few actors handle inner worlds better than she does.
Yeah, she got no credit for Vicky Cristina Barcelona, and she's excellent in that as well.
Yeah. She's good in everything. Mm. And she's really, really great in this. She plays a woman who, she's a teacher, and her husband, who was a carpenter, has just prior to the beginning of the movie, like a couple of days ago, he killed himself. Mm. And it came out of nowhere. There were no warning signs. She didn't see any red flags. It just took her completely by surprise. And she's wrestling with how to deal with this. And she's living in the house that he built for them. And she starts hearing things and like little weird stuff happens around the house. And initially her thought is, I'm grieving. weird stuff is happening and I'm grieving. But it starts happening more and more and more. She starts having more vivid dreams that she can't quite explain. And even though she actually died. Like, she was in a car accident and died for a couple minutes.
Oh, okay.
And then came back. They revived her. And she saw nothing when she died. So she believes there's nothing out there. But now she's starting to wonder if maybe her husband is a ghost and he's trying to contact her. So she starts looking into his life a little bit more. And she starts realizing that there are things that don't make sense. The book of the house that he made for them, like he drew up all the plans in this big portfolio. Mm. She never really looked at it before. And there are weird notes scrawled in it. And parts of it are built like a labyrinth and she can't explain why.
Were there runes?
Maybe there might be some runes. but also she looks through his phone and she notices a picture of her, except she doesn't own that blouse. And also she's not sure it's her. And maybe, was he having an affair? What's going on? I don't want to ruin where this is going, but I'm just laying the seed.
Sounding pretty ghosty.
It's pretty creepy. It's super duper creepy. And David Bruckner is masterfully setting the atmosphere here. It starts off, and unfortunately I don't think it ends up this way, but it starts off feeling like an instant classic in terms of like just how moody and atmospheric it is. And Rebecca Hall is actually not given a lot to work with. Like in some respects, like we don't really know a lot about her character. This is another problem we'll get to in the movie Demonic. In terms of like, what does she want? What is she interested in? What are her pursuits? What does she care about other than the plot? And that's not really in there. It's up to Rebecca Hall to add that. And what she does really brilliantly is she gives this woman who is going through a lot right now, really traumatic, you know, emotional experiences on top of grief, just everything else she's going through ends up like sort of ratcheting up the terror. Brilliantly, she has a sense of humor.
Okay.
She's not like cracking wise or anything like that.
She understands that this is a weird situation.
She is so funny.
Make jokes about
She's so fucking funny. There's this great bit where it's like late June and she's a teacher at a high school and you know the high school is sort of wrapping things up and like she shows up for one of the last days when the last day of school for the kids is not the last day of school for the teachers. They have to like put things away, file all their grades, all that kind of stuff. It takes a few days, maybe a week for teachers to sort of wrap up the school year. So she starts coming in for that, and one of the students of her kid, one of the parents of her students, comes in to sort of argue about a grade. It's like, you gave my kid a D in speech, but you said he could make it up if he did this assignment, but then on the last day of school, he came in with the assignment and you weren't there. So really, this is on you. And Rebecca Hall's just like, yeah, you're right. Yeah, see, my husband killed himself the day before, so that was really selfish of me. fine. B. Fair. You get a B. I don't give a crap. Oh, I'm so sorry. Is there anything I can do? Oh, you want an A? like, just throwing it back in her face. She's so damn funny in it. It's really, really great for most of the movie. But the problem is that as things start coming together, and the plot threads start coming together, and the mystery starts revealing what it is, it falls into a trap that I've seen some horror movies do lately, and I think it seems like a good idea until it's done, and then you realize that there's a problem here. A lot of horror movies lately, and throughout history, obviously, but I feel like the sort of A24 school of horror is trying to layer a supernatural component onto real life mental illness issues. This is something like Hereditary, for example. Midsommar, also Ari Aster, but like whatever. You know.
Did you see Relic?
I didn't, but I know of it.
Okay.
Which is
not an A24 film, but
I can't speak.
Same thing.
I can't speak to whether that one does it well because I haven't seen it. But these people are wrestling with their inner demons, their baggage, and it seems like an obvious straight line. When you're crafting a narrative, to just say, okay, so here's someone who's wrestling with grief, and maybe her husband was not a good person. Well, what if at the core of all of this was something demonic? supernatural.
Right.
And that seems like a good idea. The problem is that if you literalize that too much, you don't leave it vague. If you make it too literal, what you're saying is mental health is a fiction. Mental health is something that's outside, it's not inside, and it actually ends up kind of making a mockery of why we're here, which is to deal with real human emotion.
That was a big problem with a film called Lights Out. I think Maria Bello played the mom in that one. It was a story about mental illness, but they literalized it as the supernatural force.
And they got away with it for a little bit, but the further along the movie ended very badly. The ending of that movie is completely irresponsible. And they keep saying they're going to make a sequel. The sequel actually has an opportunity to fix that a little bit because the way that they quote unquote solve the problem in Lights Out is completely irresponsible storytelling. But that's another great example right here. And The Night House isn't that bad, but it ends up just making everything that's going on inside Rebecca Hall's head and inside the head of her husband before he died, or after, if he's a ghost. I'm not going to ruin it for you. It ends up sort of taking it away from them. And that ultimately robs the movie of a lot of its power. And instead of being about the inner struggle of an actor who's really giving it her all and is just doing all the work, and instead of making it about her and what she's going through, it ends up being about plot. It's not a huge letdown. It doesn't ruin the movie.
It is disappointing, though.
It takes it from being, clearly this was going to be a 4-star, awesome, top 10 of the year horror movie. And it makes it like a 3-star movie. Yeah. It's a downer. It's still mostly good. I do recommend it, but that's what keeps it from being truly great, because I think they just got caught up in their storytelling and they missed the point of why we were here, the thematic point, like really hard right at the end. So a damn shame. But Rebecca Hall is amazing. Super atmospheric. It's really great. And if nothing else, it is a million times better than Demonic. Demonic is a bad movie. I try to be more nuanced in my criticism than this. I know we've all done it, but Demonic is just, I'm struggling to think of something positive to say about it. Demonic is the latest
Sometimes movies are just crap.
Sometimes they just don't work. Demonic is the latest film from Neil Blomkamp, Academy Award nominated filmmaker Neil Blomkamp. He started off doing sci-fi shorts. Peter Jackson sort of latched on to him and started like giving
Peter Jackson produced District 9, if I recall.
Which was a feature film version of what's it called? It's like Lost in Nyoberg or something.
I haven't seen the short.
He had done a short film about it was a metaphor for apartheid. But the idea was
an apartheid story.
Well, it was an apartheid story, but the idea was that aliens landed on Earth, like a UFO landed. But instead of being like these like saviors or warlike species or whatever, they were refugees. And humans did what humans do.
They landed in South Africa, and they essentially set up a shanty town for them.
And they basically and
forced them to live in it.
And they became an oppressed society. And the
cops would like raid in and go through their stuff. It was just awful.
The movie District 9 is really quite good. It's on the nose, but it's really, really good. There's some amazing visual effects work in it. There's some really good performances.
Unnecessarily violent in certain sequences, but you know, that's probably part of the story.
And then Neil Blomkamp proceeded to make more feature films, which were really blunt in their messaging. He likes sci-fi allegory. So his second film, Elysium, was a really in your face metaphor for how healthcare creates economic divides. Literally, like
point where the rich live on a planet orbiting Earth, and Earth is just a wasteland.
Yeah, and Matt Damon finds out that he's dying, and the only way he can survive is if he finds a way to like join a resistance movement and make it all the way to the space station or the moon or
like
whatever.
Having this like exoskeleton implanted in his own skeleton.
It's not as good as District 9. I still kind of like that movie. Like it's got interesting ideas, and I think it's, you know, its heart's in the right place. It's not a bad film. I think people give that one kind of a bad rap. And then he made Chappie, Which Chappie, everyone hated Chappie.
A really weird animal.
Chappie is a weird, weird, weird film about a robot that's supposed to be a police robot, and it ends up accidentally gaining sentience and then hooking up with the Antwoord, playing themselves.
The real life South African rap duo, yeah. The Antwoord.
Who in this post apocalyptic or dystopian future of Chappie have taken to like a life of crime to survive. Mm.
They're living their stage personas.
Yeah, and so they end up teaching Chappie how to be a human, but unlike Ali Sheedy, who taught like Johnny Five how to be like a good person or whatever, they're teaching him how to be like,
hold up cars and
They're not teaching him wholesome values. That movie is a fucking mess, but there's some interesting stuff in it, and I don't hate it.
It's also a Hugh Jackman movie.
Yeah.
If it had like three more musical numbers than it had, which was zero.
Yeah.
If they let D'Antwoord do some rap numbers,
that'd have been a rock opera. Can you imagine?
And if they did Chappie as a rock opera, and it was just the D'Antwoord movie, which clearly he wanted to do.
I think
that would have been better.
D'Antwoord is a very controversial man. I'm not going to wade into that at all. But the movie itself.
They're dark and strange. Yeah.
But the movie is, it's not good, but it sure as hell isn't boring. And I think that's something that we need to give Neil Blomkamp some credit. I think even though he never quite found in like the last 10, I guess 12 years, I guess it's been since he's been making feature films, like that next District 9, that next thing that just really popped, he's always been trying something really interesting. So it's really frustrating to watch a film in which he didn't. Demonic is a low-budget horror movie starring Carly Pope as a woman named Carly. Mm-hmm.
Coincidence, I'm sure.
Total coincidence. At the beginning of the movie, we are introduced to her. She is a person. And what we know about her I'm going off of what the movie tells us. Here's what we know about her.
All we know is she's a person.
She's a person. Here's what we know about her. She has an affinity for brightly colored poofy jackets.
Okay.
And she likes to wear a backpack. That's it. That's all I know about her. I don't know what she does for a living. I don't know.
She works at the camping supply store.
You would think. She has a friend played by Candace McClure from Battlestar Galactica. And she has a vague backstory, which they speak about vaguely for no other reason than the movie will explain it later. It turns out that her estranged mother, who is estranged for reasons which we will explain later, is in a coma. Mm-hmm. She didn't know. They haven't spoken to her in many years. And the organization that is taking care of her wants her to come visit. And so in the interest of pursuing some sense of closure, she does. And that's when she finds out that her mother is, not only is she in a coma, but she's in a coma in a facility that has a new form of technology that will allow her not unlike the movie The Cell, but it doesn't look nearly as cool, project her virtually into her mother's subconscious.
Okay.
So that they can communicate and say, well, here's the deal. Your mother is in a locked-in state. Her consciousness is secure, but she has no way of communicating with the outside world. Because you're connected to her, we would like you to jump into her brain and just see if she's okay. And she agrees to this because apparently it's actually quite easy. They just throw a little squid thing on her head and it just pops in. And it looks like a glitchy video game. It looks pretty cheap. And, you know, you think to yourself, okay, so we're going to go inside the mind of the estranged mother. I never knew. And it turns out, by the way, that the reason why she's estranged is because she's a mass murderer. So you would think we're going to, like, go into her head and we're going to see something really kind of weird, right? Something kind of like...
Like in the movie The Cell.
It's like something revealing, something, you know, that wouldn't take advantage of this premise. And we see a house and another time there's another building. We didn't need any CGI to do any of this stuff. But it turns out that, and this isn't like the Night House where I can, like, I want to be vague about it. This is right at the beginning of the movie. It turns out her mother has never been mentally ill. She has been possessed this whole time. So all of the baggage that our protagonist has allegedly been going through, but shows literally no examples of, is kind of invalidated because she had no reason to actually be mad at her mother. And her mother has actually been this completely, like, protective person this whole time. And now, of course, the demon is after Carly. And it turns out also the Vatican has an assassination squad of demon hunters who don't know how to Google things. So they keep having to ask her questions. And it's a stupid movie. It is a movie that none of the characters make any kind of impression. Even the main character, who is in pretty much every shot. There's nothing, there's no depth to it. There's no resonance, like, actual exploration of its themes. Nothing about it feels human, so nothing about it can possibly feel scary.
Yeah,
the sci-fi technology bit you would think would go somewhere with it, you could remove that and change it to your mother is, like, in a padded cell and won't speak to anybody but she'll speak to you, and you would have the exact same movie.
How about the mother has access to a one-eyed demon skull that she keeps in a basement, and it's been possessing a local cop who's been turning into a serial killer? That's the plot of the TV series Hellstrom.
It is. Which is not a good TV series.
No, it's not.
But it was better than this.
Oh, that's
because at least Hellstrom
good.
Had an interesting character in it once. The sister's okay.
Sister's okay. The mom is really good.
Yeah, that's it.
The actress who played the mom is really good.
Demonic doesn't have that. Demonic has nothing going for it. There's this incredibly absurd bit later on in the movie where all of the demon assassins have shown up to this place in order to, you know, bring the demon out into the world and kill it. And they brought all of their machine guns and their weapons and all that kind of stuff. And our hero gets there, and they're all, of course, they're already all dead, except for one guy. And the guy's dying, and he tells, you know, Carly, like, oh, you're going to have to go in there and stop it. Here, use this magical spear. It's the only thing that can kill demons. Then why did you try to shoot it? Why did you bring all these guns? What was the point? You just died for no reason. Use the fucking spear. Mm. Nothing in this... The plot doesn't work. Mm. Like, I complain about the Nighthouse and how it became all about the plot. At least the plot makes sense. Here, the plot doesn't make sense. The characters don't make sense. The themes don't make sense. The sci-fi doesn't make sense. Everything about it is really stupid.
I really hate that guns are so default in, like, demon movies.
Yeah.
Do you remember in the first Terminator film where Michael Biehn gives a handgun to Sarah Connor and says, if the Terminator comes after you, you're armed, you have this handgun, but it's been proven that this thing can easily survive gunshots.
Yeah.
It's like, how about if you see it, just run? You know, you can empty that whole gun right into the Terminator's face.
Like, we've established that a shotgun can slow the Terminator down a bit, so that might be useful. But
she's given a handgun.
I know. Here's my thing with that. I feel like in that, having a weapon makes her feel a little bit more secure than being completely unarmed.
I suppose.
I feel like that's. It's not like he comes back in time with a truckload of weapons. He's got like two guns.
Yeah.
I'll have the shotgun, and you'll have this other gun. Mine will be useful because I know how to use it in a stressful situation and you do not. I feel like that one, maybe not this example, but I see your point.
We're going to go up to a demon and so we're bringing guns just in case, even though we know it doesn't hurt the demon.
Yeah.
Do they fire the guns? Is there like a machine gun
presumably
battle?
Well, it's all off camera because it's a low budget movie.
Oh.
But
well,
at least
there's
not
like a gunfight with the demon on camera.
Yeah, no, but like, but it didn't work. That's the thing. Because only thing that would work in the spear, which we brought with us and decided to leave in the car. What was the point of this?
I watch fight scenes, especially in superhero movies, where it's just like these high-octane boxing matches.
Yeah.
It's like, is somebody going to get, like, knocked unconscious during one of these? Is that why you're fighting? Like, what is going to be the end of this? Are you going to kill somebody? Is that what they're trying to do?
I guess it depends on the fight scene you're thinking about. I could maybe tell you a theory. Right. But,
you know, I've seen a lot of like high octane super brawls, and
for example, what
the point of those is supposed to be.
For example,
like, how is that supposed to end up?
The fight between Captain America, the Winter Soldier, and Iron Man at the end of Captain America Civil War, Iron Man is trying to kill the Winter Soldier because he killed his parents. So that one actually is trying to kill him. And Captain America is fighting to prevent him from killing him. And the Winter Soldier is doing that to prevent himself from dying.
Okay.
So, like, that one, that's one that kind of makes sense in that regard.
His goal is to actually murder that guy.
Yeah, or, like, at the end of The Incredible Hulk, when the Hulk is fighting the Abomination just wants to destroy, and the Hulk is in his way, and the Hulk is indestructible, so they're just doing the best that they can.
They're just, like, wailing on each other for no real reason.
Well, it's like a kaiju movie, isn't it? Like, you know, have a great reason for Godzilla to fight
See, when Godzilla...
the lobster creature...
Ebira, the horror of the
Ebira, the horror of the deep. Thank you.
When Godzilla fights Mechagodzilla, Godzilla twists his fucking head off at the end.
Right.
Godzilla is there to kill that monster.
I appreciate that.
There's a lot more clarity to those fights.
I don't disagree.
Those are more exciting, more intelligent movies.
I think, but that's the thing. I think if you're going to have, even in a superhero movie, we talked about some Paw Patrol, you need to justify the action sequence. And saving people will justify any action sequence. Mm. But if that's not the case and people are fighting each other, it can't be like, oh, we have to stop to press this button. Like, no, there are other ways to do that.
Yeah,
more effective ways, less violent ways. Like, there's got to be something else. And I think the best superhero movies, like the fight scene we all talk about from, like, Captain America Civil War, we didn't need that.
No.
That's it's just fun to watch because we finally get to see all these heroes fight each other.
Exciting choreography.
Yeah, there's cool stuff in it.
Yeah, you know, because they're all have a different superpower. Yeah. They each have like a gimmick and a different way of fighting.
But basically, they want to, it's basically, and I've described it before, it's like the biggest, most expensive game of Red Rover in cinematic history.
Yeah, more or less.
We're standing in a line, you're standing in a line, we're all going to run at each other, and the goal is to get over there. There are other ways to get over there. Have you tried driving around the airport? You know, maybe Ant-Man could shrink all of us and just, we could just slip by unnoticed. There's a million different things you could do. Anyway, Demonic is not a good film. And that is all I'm going to say about that.
It doesn't sound like it. And
again, I'm not one of these people who's been crapping on Neil Blomkamp this whole time. I know a lot of people didn't like his follow-ups to District 9. I think Elysium is fine. I think Chappie is a mess, but it's not an uninteresting mess. Demonic is frustratingly uninteresting, and it really does feel like he doesn't have any interest in the horror genre, and the sci-fi element is not interestingly explored either. This feels like some kind of weird exercise that got out of hand and accidentally got released to the world. Like, no, this is a bad motion picture. But there's one last film we're talking about this week, and you saw it and I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me about CryptoZoo.
CryptoZoo is an animated film that's playing in some indie theaters around town. It's playing at the New Art right now. And it is about a zoo full of cryptids. That is an animal whose existence hasn't really been fully substantiated yet.
Yeah, it's only rumor. Unicorns, yeah. Bigfoots.
Yeah, and
jackalopes.
And the film opens with like a hippie couple wandering out into the woods and saying, oh no, we're lost, and they lay down and they have sex, and they wander off and find this gigantic fence in the middle of the woods. They climb over it, they see a unicorn, they are not really sure what to make of the unicorn, they antagonize it, it kills one of them.
Like impales it with the thing.
With the horn, nice. As revenge, the woman kills the unicorn.
Okay.
And she's like, oh shit, I killed a unicorn. What am I going to do? Like, picks up her dead boyfriend and starts carrying him through the woods. Comes upon some pit toilets and some, like, crew guys, like, tending to, like, zoo cages.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the cages are full of cryptid various monsters from around the country.
I can't imagine they're happy that she killed their unicorn.
No, they're quite upset. And we then shift focus to the main character of the story, played by Lake Bell. She plays a character named Lauren, who has made it her goal to travel the world looking for other cryptids to put in this zoo. And the description of the zoo is very much like Jurassic Park. It's supposed to be like a theme park for people to come in and meet the cryptids, but the cryptids also like run the merchandise counters and sell food to people.
Okay.
And it's sold as this kind of utopia, but it's also this really kind of like crassly commercial thing, like a sideshow.
Yeah.
She's really in search of something called a Baku, which is a little like miniature elephant monster that can eat dreams out of your head. And she encountered this thing as a child and is really attached to it. Meanwhile, the military are on her tail and are also looking for cryptids. She teams up with a satyr and Medusa so they can go out into the world and find other cryptids. On paper, this sounds like the most insufferable young adult novel that you've ever read. And a lot of the dialogue plays out that way. Oh no, the military is after us, and everything's very perfunctory, and the plot is very predictable.
Yeah.
And you know, it's like, we need all these bromides about people fear what's different, so we're just going to kill the Kraken.
See, when you described it, I was thinking, like, what if Wes Anderson did this? It sounds like that's the vibe that would be down for.
The dialogue is kind
of twee and cute.
It's very perfunctory, and it feels kind of twee because it actually is laid back to a fault. Everything's delivered in this very sort of lazy fashion. Everybody's really kind of laid back. Nothing ever really seems to feel dramatic, even when like guns start going off and helicopters start crashing.
Mm.
And the style of animation is like a very rudimentary style, like pencil drawings with like watercolors.
Okay.
Did you ever see the Henry Darger documentary?
I did. What was it?
What was that one called? Henry Darger was an outsider artist. He was a janitor who never talked to anybody, but secretly back in his very, very small apartment was working on this epic thousands and thousands of page novel about this ongoing war between this army of godlike little girls and the evil forces that would destroy the world. And when he had a heart attack and was taken to the hospital, they finally discovered this thing that he'd been working on.
He died, and it was only after he died that they actually went into his apartment.
They found this before he died.
Oh, that's right.
They actually talked to him about it. It's like, you've been working on this.
And it's all incredible.
And this is all amazing. Can we put it out to the world? And his comment was, it's too late now.
Yeah.
Like, you should have caught me when I was working on this thing. I'm done.
I will never be able to enjoy people enjoying my work.
He died shortly thereafter.
Yeah, the film is called In the Realms of the Unreal, Mystery of Henry Darger.
Yeah, and if you've seen that,
it's a good documentary.
The animation in CryptoZoo looks like Henry Darger art.
Oh, okay.
Like, it has this kind of outsider, hand-drawn, like, something you would draw in your notes in high school kind of quality to it, and the movements are all very kind of jerky and blendy, interesting kinds of stiff non-movements to convey actual movement. And when it starts talking about abstract things and about dreams or showing montages, it goes into these weird sort of kaleidoscopic visuals where everything starts to overlap. And in those moments, it becomes really quite beautiful. There's even kind of a comic version of that when they're describing the crypto zoo itself. It's like, and we're going to go through the crypto zoo. And everybody works at these food stations. And in fact, we have food from all over the world. You can get pizza. And over here, you can get pad thai. Like, they're describing the most, like, banal things. But we get to see all of these things kind of swirl together.
The real appeal
of
the crypto zoo is you can get pad thai.
And we've been able to bring everybody in. Some of them are animals that can be tamed. The only animals we haven't been able to domesticate are the wild rock and the kraken, and we have these things. And of course, the rock ends up attacking a helicopter later in the movie.
What's the rock?
The giant bird, the rock.
Took me a second.
Not Dwayne Johnson. He's not a cryptid.
I was just thinking of like a big rock. Like, it's just big rock. We haven't been able to tame this rock yet. We're not even sure it's a cryptid, really. It's just sort of here.
I think Dwayne the Rock Johnson might be a cryptid.
I wouldn't be shocked.
Yeah.
A
Samoan cryptid. Michael Cera is in this. He's the army guy. Peter Stormare plays the satyr. Zoe
Deschanel?
Kazan. Oh, Zoe Kazan. Yeah, I love Zoe Kazan.
Yeah, she's great.
She shows up in this as well. It does skew into a lot of cliche by the end, though, and you do realize that there's not a script here.
Oh.
They had a lot. It's partially made by a comic book author. His name is Dash Shaw.
Oh, okay, I know that name. I don't know that name.
He did comics called Cosplayers, Doctors, New School, and Bottomless Belly Button.
Maybe I'm thinking of someone else. Maybe I know other works.
Clearly, he wanted to make a feature film. He's interested in cryptids, but this treats cryptids like they're X-Men.
She did that movie, My Entire High School Sinking into the Sea.
Oh, I didn't see
that
one.
Okay, that's what I know the name from. Okay.
He also did this film, Crypto Zoo, and you can tell he's a lot of passion for bringing sort of a lot of interesting visuals, but he doesn't have a story here. There's nothing really fascinating. Like, he started with Crypto Zoo and ended up just falling back into like these really safe, really tired, boring cliches to the point where you realize he didn't really have an idea here. This feels really, really unformed. It almost feels like the first draft of a movie rather than the completed product. So at the end, it just isn't all that substantial. It kind of like lulls you for a little bit and you get sort of slowed down by its kind of nice slow pace and mellow atmosphere.
But to no particular end.
Yeah, but yeah, yeah, it's just sort of slowing you down and after a while you're just slow.
Well, so a big old mixed bag of a week, huh?
Yeah, a little bit of a mixed bag.
Yeah, all right. So we're going to review our films on the critically acclaimed scale. The critically acclaimed scale is thus. It goes from C-, below average, we don't recommend it, to a C, average, little hit or miss. Maybe you'll dig it, maybe you won't. And then C+, we definitely recommend it. Maybe it's even great. And that's, I used to say that most films are average. Oh. And then in the recent episode of We've Got Mail, we found out that we're a little kinder than we thought. we give more passing grades than we realize. So technically, most movies, by a slim margin, are good. So we are not tyrannical monsters as film critics go.
As critics, when you post on Rotten Tomatoes, I'm not sure if they even still have this, but they'll give you like your name and how often you agree with the consensus tomato meter.
I haven't checked that in a long time. I don't know if they still do that. Yeah.
And like my agreement meter was like in the high 70s and I was a little bit embarrassed. Like, no, I want to be more contrarian than that.
Right?
I don't want to agree with the tomato meter, but you know, I have to be honest.
No, it's the way it works out. The way it works out. But in any case, we always go in reverse order. So Whitney, tell us, how does Crypto Zoo pan out on the critically acclaimed scale?
I really wanted to like this more. I like cryptids. I like cryptozoology. It's an interest of mine. But yeah, they don't do anything interesting with this story. So it's a C-.
That's a shame.
It's ultimately not a success.
Demonic is just not a good movie. Nothing about it works. The characters don't work. The performances aren't particularly good. There's like one decent scare in it, but that's not a lot for even a short film.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a big old whiff. So yeah, that's a big old C-. It's definitely... One of the worst movies I've seen all year.
Ugh,
which is just a damn
shame.
I'm
so sorry.
The Night House is also a bit of a mixed bag because it starts off great and then it never quite comes together. I cannot in good conscience give it a C-, just because it doesn't really like ever get bad. It just never achieves its full potential. So I'm going to give it... do I give it a high C or a low C+?
It's your heart.
I'm going to give it a high C. I think it's so close to being great, but it takes one step way back. However, Rebecca Hall is giving a C+ performance, which sounds a lot better in the context of our podcast than it does in a vacuum. Rebecca Hall is giving an amazing performance.
Yes.
All right, Reminiscence.
I know I have the minority opinion, but I am giving it a C+. I liked the richness of the world. I liked the science fiction conceit. I think it's just really a pretty well-constructed film.
Mm-hmm.
And I did like the performances. And I do like that it's kind of dour and hopeless at the end. It didn't end up that the science fiction conceit can fix everything. It's all still about that human beings will suffer and die.
That is... all of the things you like about it are the things I like about it, except ultimately I feel that the romance at the heart of it never quite justifies the plot. I feel like they kind of sort of miscalculated how emotional that should be. I think that dourness is too present at the beginning, even though I'm fine with a dour ending. So for me, it's a low C. It's definitely not a bad movie, but it doesn't quite come together, and I don't think it maximizes the potential of the concept. The Protégé is a very pleasant C+, just a really rock-solid, well-crafted, well-acted, impressively sexy assassin movie from director Martin Campbell with a really, really good cast. So if I recommend it.
Nice, he's still got it. I remember really digging on GoldenEye way back in the day.
It's a mature action thriller that really does work, and I do hope more people take a look at it. And then lastly, Paw Patrol.
I'll give it a C.
Okay.
It's bright and heroic and okay for little kids. It's not terribly sophisticated, but it's not designed that way.
Yeah, this is very clearly intended for a young audience, and so you do have to consider that. I think, you know, as an adult, you're going to be a little bored, perhaps.
Well,
but it's not here for you, is it?
Consider this. And I'm not saying think like a parent, but think what sort of messages is a film like Paw Patrol giving to a young child?
I agree. And I think the messages are pretty good.
The messages are pretty good. We're talking about, you know, defunding the police, but those are more sophisticated things that a kid won't be keying into.
I agree with that, and I think that there, that's my issue with it as a film, is that I feel like it could have been a little more solidly developed without undermining all of these good, nice kid things about it. Mm. I don't think they went that far. It's kind of a bummer. So that's why it's not a C+. And I do think there are a couple too many, like, fat jokes and jokes about...
I don't remember any fat jokes.
There's just a couple of things about how, like, the pug dog is all... The bulldog is always needs food and, oh, he doesn't fit in his clothes. And just these little things that are just... They're just little things. But they're prevalent and they're pervasive and they don't seem to be very well examined. And little things like that. Not so much that they ruin the movie, but they're worth noting that it isn't, like, entirely, you know, golden. But... yeah, this is a, by and large, this is a harmless little movie. Mm. And I think that in terms of it's trying to espouse something positive and it mostly succeeds and it's not doing some of the worst things that kids movies do lately. Mm. I gotta get at least give it a C. I think it's just okay.
It's upbeat. Yeah. Positive. It is innocuous and
yeah. If I had children,
unsophisticated movie.
If I had children and they really wanted to watch this, there are other kids' movies I would much prefer they not watch instead.
Right.
So I would be like, okay, fine, you can watch Paw Patrol the movie again. Knock yourself out.
I'm so glad we got
Paramount Plus.
I think I may have mentioned this before, but I took my kid to see The Secret Life of Pets 2.
Oh, yeah.
And we didn't make it through... I didn't review it because we didn't make it through the whole thing. Yeah. He wanted to leave before the movie was over. There were some scary wolves in it, and he was too
scared. Yeah, the bad guy has, like, hench wolves that are pretty...
Also, my son doesn't really care much for movies. Like, he's not excited to be in a theater. Once he was done with his soda, the movie was over. It's like, okay, I'm done.
I'm here for the snacks, damn it.
More or less. That's
how I am at baseball games. I'm here for the big hot dog. And I ate the big hot dog, and now I'm done. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
But when I was watching that movie, and I'm with my young child, and I'm thinking, what is he getting from this movie? And The Secret Life of Pets 2 is an incredibly mean-spirited movie. All the jokes are based on humiliating other characters or making mocking how they feel about the world.
Yeah, like the protagonist's dog is really protective of a child and is a bit neurotic.
He's a very fearful character.
But the solution to his problem is to be a man.
Well, that's not healthy. That's not what I'm taking from it. What I'm taking from it is that he is a fearful character and all of the other characters are laughing at him for being fearful and humiliating him for being fearful.
And the solution isn't that they need to understand him better. The solution is that our hero dog is supposed to buck up. And I think that's part and parcel is my point.
The solution is that these other characters are not being told to be kind.
Exactly.
That's my point.
Exactly. I went about it the other way, but yes, I agree with you. That's exactly what I'm saying.
And, you know, a dog arrives at a farm and says, wow, I'm excited to be on a farm. And the cow makes fun of the dog for being excited.
Mm-hmm.
There is a lot of, like, slapping and yelling and mucking in a movie like that. Mm-hmm. And I'm realizing that my kid is not old enough for something like The Secret Life of Pets 2.
Yeah. Paw Patrol, it's not a healthy attitude to espouse to a little kid. Yeah.
Skews younger than The Secret Life. Like, a 9-year-old could see Secret Life of Pets. Paw Patrol's for, like, 4-year-olds. Mm-hmm. But, it's a preschool movie, but it's, as a result, a lot more positive and wholesome. And I think a kid gets something a little bit better from a movie like Paw Patrol.
And I think that's great. Mm. Okay, so that is it for Critically Acclaimed this week. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll be back next week with more reviews. Mm. Probably of something.
Next week is the next Avengers movie, isn't it?
No, it's a week after, isn't it?
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, maybe so.
It's the first week in, like, September. Oh, I think it's the first Marvel movie to open in September. I think that's why I remember that.
Oh, okay.
So we got like another week or two for that. There's other stuff coming out, I guess. I don't know. We'll see it when we see it, won't we?
We'll be reviewing the new Ted Bundy movie.
There's another Ted Bundy movie.
This one with Elijah Wood.
Oh my God.
It's about the birth of FBI profiling and how Ted Bundy was actually very... extensively interviewed about his mental illnesses
That David Fincher series was about too? Mindhunters?
Oh,
it was about like the birth of the FBI profile. Okay, well, anyway,
I guess here's a movie about the same thing.
All
right. Going to be talking about other films. The new Candyman film is coming out next week too.
Oh, is that this week?
Yeah, Candyman 4 is coming out.
I'm actually excited about. Yeah. So we'll be reviewing all that stuff, and I hope it's good. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you. Very special thank you to all of our patrons over at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork.
Yes, indeed.
Without you, we wouldn't be here. No one would have any of these shows, even if you're not a Patreon. Even if you're not a patron, these shows would not be here. So thank you to all of our patrons. You're the reason we're here. Thank you so much. Yeah, if you want to become a patron, you get a bunch of exclusive shows. You can head over to patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. We'd love to see you. We're doing an online hangout later this week. Check your local listings. Mm-hmm. We're also on Twitter at Critic Acclaim. I am at William Bibbiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibold.
If you want to write in about anything we discussed on this episode or anything else you want to talk about, we have a podcast called We've Got Mail, and we respond to your emails. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We also have a P.O. box, which I keep forgetting to memorize. Whitney?
Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
And we also have some other stuff that we do as well. I run a soap store with my partner M. Lampas da Silva. It's an online store over on Etsy. We're on social media and Instagram at Saltcat Soap. But if you head on over to the Etsy store Saltcat Soap, we have handcrafted designer soaps, and we release new designs every single month, sometimes in between as well. And we've got fancy smelling soaps, we've got lotions as well, bath salts, stickers with Luca on them. It's all over there. So thank you, everybody, who's already bought some stuff. Leave us a review if you haven't. The reviews have been really kind, so we're really grateful for that. And then Whitney has another podcast that we sometimes forget to mention.
That's right. Over on The Screen's Margins, which is the network run by B. Peterson, they and I talk about what we watched on Ovid that week. Ovid is a really wonderful streaming service that you should probably be subscribing to. Which has all the deep cut art house stuff that you've never heard of.
If Criterion is too commercial for you, Ovid is the place to go.
Yeah, if you remember wanting to see that one movie that was playing at your local museum for a day, but you couldn't go because it was at 11:30 a.m. on a Wednesday, that's on Ovid now. Go see it there. If you want to see oblique political French movies that are over 5 hours in length, that's where you go. And so B and I really love Ovid, and so we just talk about whatever we got to on Ovid.
I think that's great.
We've been talking about the films of Patricio Guzman, the Chilean filmmaker who did the Nostalgia for the Light and the Cordillera of Dreams. So, yeah, a lot of interesting discussions happening there.
That's awesome. All right, so thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll see you all around at all of those places. And never forget, everyone's a critic.
I want to go to the midnight show. I'm sorry, what?